A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, X, I went too far, Z, Y, X, W, V, U, T, S, R, Q, P, Q, R, S, T. Hello, 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 welcome, welcome, gather round, children, for the latest episode of P, Q, R, S, T, Parody, Quips, Rants, and storytelling. Today our main thrust for the podcast will be the 41st entry out of the top 50 grossing movies of all time as of 2010 in the nitpicking category, The Lost World, Jurassic Park 2. But before we get to the nitpicking, Daddy has a bit of a rant. I have spoken on at least one previous podcast about the importance of yes and. It is an improv term, and as much as I really try not to repeat myself, and I like to have something fresh and new each time, this one bears going back to. So, to recap, a lot of attitudes around... Well, let's just narrow it down to the improv world. Let's say that I'm in a scene with another fellow. We'll call him Albert. And so Albert and I are going to do the alphabet game, where the next line that each person says starts with the next letter of the alphabet. And someone in the audience says that our location is the Batcave, which somebody actually said once. And if you're out there, thank you. Thank you so much for giving an intelligent and interesting suggestion at improv instead of the doctor's office that we get 99% of the time. So anyway, Albert and I are in the Batcave, and I'll kick off the scene, and I'll say to Albert, "Quick, the Batmobile!" And Albert, since it's alphabet game, needs to say something that starts with R, and he could say, "Right, I'll go get it, Master Bruce," making me Batman. Or he could say, "Robin just left with it," making him whoever, but still putting the scene along. But if I say, "Quick, the Batmobile!" And Albert says, "Really? We're going to do a scene like that?" Or, "Right, I don't know if I want to play superheroes today." Basically, if Albert does that, he has done no but. Whereas the first couple versions that I said are yes and. In a nutshell, saying yes and in an improv scene is you say something to me, and regardless of how wild or weird or especially unexpected it is, if I say, "Quick, the Batmobile," and Albert says, "Robin just left with it," my ability to yes and, QRS, would be, I could be like, "Sounds of silence, we need to chase after him." Or it could be, "Simply fire up the Batcopter." But if I go, you know, "Quick, the Batmobile," and Albert says, "Robin just left with it." Stupid, Robin's right here. I've just said no but. Yes and is taking whatever's unexpected, even if it's something that, as an improver, you wouldn't say, or that you're not keen on, and agreeing, affirming, and building. So, because I was literally in a scene once, and I know I'm repeating myself here, but where I was working with someone else who shall remain nameless, and God bless him, he has a good heart, just not the greatest improver, and we were doing a scene, and I don't even remember what was going on, but I said to him, "Blah, blah, 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 blah," and he's like, "No, that's not what's going on." And just like that, the scene keeled over dead, because what do you do with that? So if you're ever on an improv stage, say yes and beyond just being on an improv stage, because most of the people out there won't be, although I highly encourage it. If you get a chance, absolutely try it. It is so much fun and so stretching and good for a person. But you can apply this to life. And the reason I've been thinking about this lately is because I have a friend, and once again, he shall remain nameless, but God bless him, and he drives me up the wall. And we are this close, he doesn't realize it, but he's this close to being on my everybody gets to see this but you list for my Facebook posts. Because, a couple days ago, I saw something weird outside. It's kind of interesting. I took a picture of it, posted on Facebook, and made a reference to a superhero that I like. Just, you know, because there was a light shining on the fence, looked a little like the bat signal, and so, you know, I took a picture of that, said, "Hey, you know, kind of like the bat signal." And a yes and could be, "Yeah, call Robin," or, "Hey, it's Commissioner Gordon," or, "That's cool," or whatever. I wasn't asking for people to tell me I was amazing. You know, just, if you see this and you get a giggle out of it, you can like it or make a positive comment, move on with your day. I don't even care if you respond. I just wanted to share it with the world. His response was something to the effect of, oh, I wouldn't call that superhero, I'd call this superhero. Basically saying, your choice is wrong and mine would be better. He does this a lot. Recently, he posted onto my timeline a picture of a thing that he likes that was, in his opinion, really cool, which is fine. I have no problem with that. But the way he posted it wasn't, hey, here's this thing I like doing a thing that's really cool. It was like, the way he posted it was, hey, this thing that does this, or no, how do you say it? He was like, hey, I'll bet this thing that you like can't do this. And he was right. The element of my life that he was referring to did not have the ability that the element of his life was referring to. So what? Are we 7 years old? He is 7 years old emotionally. And that's the thing I try to remind myself, is that while he's five times that age physically, he is an emotional seven-year-old. And I'm just trying to love him because God has told me that he needs love. But it's starting to drive me crazy. And there's just no need to do that. We don't have to go through life saying, my dad could beat up your dad, or my dad makes more money than your dad, or my dad's taller than your dad. Why does everything have to be a comparison? Why does everything with some people, and if I'm not speaking to you, then obviously I'm not speaking to you. Don't worry about it. Have to be an argument. I have another friend, and this is a guy who I can't imagine ever hearing this podcast. We haven't spoken better part of 20 years, but we knew each other in high school. Every time I said anything, he had to have a better story. He always had to be topping me. If I had bought a new car that went, you know, this fast, he had a new car that went even faster. If I had started a small business, he was about to get his doctorate or something. And the only times he ever had nothing to come back with was when he actually had nothing to come back with. When I would tell him about my writing, and he had nothing because he wasn't trying to write. And so he would just ignore me if it was something that he couldn't do better than. But everything else, he would top me. And I'll never forget, we were both on a school trip, and we were playing chess in the van on the way, because we were the cool kids, and he was a better chess player than I am, which is true of just about anybody, and I managed to pull a draw. I managed to stalemate him, and what would it have cost him to say, hey, you played a good game, or wow, nicely done? What he said was, man, I'm really off my game today. Thank you ever so much. That was not a yes and. That was not a affirming, a building. It was a, well, I guess you beat me, but only because I'm doing really terrible. If I was on my regular game, this would not have happened. So, as I'm describing these descriptions, as I'm making putting these examples out there, if you're hearing yourself, take a moment to think about that. If, as I'm describing a person who always has to win, who always has to one-up, I mean, I like telling stories, and if somebody tells a story that reminds me of a story, I do like to tell that story, but I hope that, and if you know me and you're listening to this and you want to check me on this, feel free, videoninja@juno.com, or find me on Facebook, Will Nestle, but I feel like, by and large, it was really hard to get that phrase out. I'm going to take a moment. All right. I feel like most of the time, if I'm telling a story that someone else's story has reminded me of, it's to enjoy the storytelling game, you know, to go back and forth. I don't mind when I tell a story and then someone says, I had something like that happen to me, and then tell their story. It's so different from someone who's like, oh yeah, you think that's amazing? Listen to this. The attitude of, my story's better than yours. My experience was better than yours. I'm better than you. I'm winning the conversation. That's what I have a problem with, not the storytelling aspect. So again, if this is ringing any bells with anybody, if you're out there and you're like, that sounds a lot like me, may I encourage you to think about the way you're living your life. Maybe take some improv classes, seriously, because I didn't know about yes and I'd like to say I had some ability at yes and even before I understood the concept, but the specifics of yes anding, I try to apply it to life, and I really try to listen more than I talk, and I try not to top other people. I try to be affirming, and there have been times where somebody posted something on Facebook, and I could have made a really dry, witty remark that, I got one up on them, and that I haven't, because I wouldn't want someone to do that to me. There are also times where I've gone ahead, and later I've thought, wow, I could have been a lot nicer there, or I could have let them have their moment. And anyway, I'm trying to do that more. So please, yes, and just a thought. Meanwhile, moving on to the point of the podcast, Jurassic Park 2. Loved the original movie, as did a billion or so other people. Spielberg is a genius. He really is brilliant, and he does amazing work. It can be argued, and has been, that the movies that he and Lucas and others now, like Michael Bay and other, the popcorn movies, and I would say I will stack up any Spielberg movie against any five Michael Bay movies in terms of quality, but that the popcorn genre, which most of Spielberg's movies are, Schindler's List, not a popcorn film, but E.T., Jurassic Park, 1942, most of what he's done, you know, it's not life-changing, thought-provoking, or is it? But they're not critically, but they can be critically acclaimed. How do I define this? They're not Sophie's Choice. They're not Remains of the Day. They're not auteur films. They are big blockbuster popcorn movies, but he does things very well. And Jurassic Park, I mean, the 7-year-old dinosaur lover in most of us, he brought that out, just like E.T. reached in and touched something deep within a lot of us. Jurassic Park did too. And when I heard there was going to be a sequel, was like, okay. I mean, yes, there was a second book. And I, at this point, don't remember how closely the movie and the book coincided. I feel like The Lost World, Michael Crichton's novel, you saw more of in Jurassic Park 3, which probably means I need to read The Lost World again. But I remember thinking, oh, it didn't need a sequel. It was good as it was. And a lot of times I think that and I'm right. This was one of those times, and for Jurassic Park 3, and from what I hear, World, although to be fair, I haven't seen it, 3 did not need to happen. And I've heard World did not need to happen, but 2 was pretty cool. Necessary? No. But I didn't mind going back to that world again, and I especially didn't mind that I got to go back there with, Jeff Goldblum. There, I knew his name would pop out. I missed Sam Neill a little bit, but I like Jeff Goldblum a lot, except for that thing he did where he was turning into a fly, which gave me vomit nightmares. Let's move on. One of my favorite quotes from the movie, my version? There aren't any versions of the truth. Obviously, Dr. Malcolm had never met our current presidential administration. Alternative fact. So, my comment at the start of the blog post and book chapter was that this cash flow movie didn't really add anything to the world the way Jurassic Park did, but how great is it to have a T-Rex loose in San Diego? That is just fun cinema. As usual, just 20 seconds into the film, I make fun of the Universal logo, and honestly, this isn't my idea. It came from the Mystery Science Theater, This Island Earth. The Universal logo, not a cloud in the sky, and they're like, it's the best weather Earth's ever had. Well, so the main thrust of the movie is there's dinosaurs still alive on the island, and we need to send Dr. Malcolm back for some purpose. I think maybe Hammond goes back and Dr. Malcolm goes to rescue him or something. I don't even remember what it is. There's dinosaurs still alive on the island, and the whole movie is basically, let's get some more people eaten and let's come up with a way to set a T-Rex loose in San Diego, which I don't have a big problem with because it's a lot of fun to watch a T-Rex loose in San Diego. Nothing even against San Diego. It could have been New York or Poughkeepsie. It's just fun to see. So, we start with, and it's interesting that the start of The Lost World, Jurassic Park 2, is actually taken from the start of the novel Jurassic Park. I'm guessing it's one of those things they wanted in the original movie and had to cut for time. We see these incredibly rich people with their private beach on their private island, and the little kid is attacked by little dinosaurs, and it's just not a fun scene for me, especially since the horrible mother of the child is not the one eaten by the dinosaurs. Anyway, moving on, we discover that there's dinosaurs on the island, and Dr. Ian Malcolm has come back to do whatever it is. Oh, I know why. His girlfriend, Sarah, has gone to the island because she's dying to see dinosaurs, and he has to go to get her off there because he knows just how bad it's going to be. And I think early on in the movie, they talk about how he told everybody how bad it was, and nobody really believed him. 18 minutes, 49 seconds, describing... So they've gotten to the island. They're going to see the dinosaurs anyway, because we're here. And they have a high hide, a little platform that can be raised up in the trees. And I put this in because I love the quote. It puts the researchers out of harm's way. Ian Malcolm's response, actually, it puts them at a very convenient biting height, which is just one of my favorite lines ever. And it's a great line. But right as he says it, his position changes when the shot changes. So there's a continuity error. But I don't mention a lot of continuity errors. I only mention this one because, hey, it's a great line. 23 minutes, 44 seconds. One of the things that happens when a nitpicker's looking at movies, the categories I have, I call this a peripheral vision problem, or PVP. Nick the photographer, who has come along with Ian Malcolm to get some Pulitzer-winning shots of dinosaurs, gets on a log to get a better shot. They're still looking for Sarah. The camera reveals that Sarah is 10 feet from Nick. Shouldn't he have been able to see her? Because suddenly he's like, oh, you're there. Peripheral vision problem. Plus, the location puts her in easy range of the shouting the boys were just doing trying to find her. Why hasn't she responded? 24 minutes, 40 seconds. This is interesting. Malcolm and Sarah are supposed to be, like, in a really close relationship. Malcolm picks up Sarah's pack, her favorite thing in the world, asks if she's been attacked because it's all dirty and scungy and full of holes. She responds, my lucky pack always looks like that. Malcolm doesn't know this. They are obviously not very close. 26 minutes, 45 seconds. Nick the photographer might want to consider some ADHD medicine, because in one shot he's framing a photograph with his little video camera. 15 seconds later, he's got his 35mm camera out. 10 seconds later, he's got the video camera out again. Sure, there's enough time for him to switch out the cameras while we're looking at something else, but really not enough time to get any decent pictures. I mean, just make a decision already. 27 minutes, 50 seconds. Sarah agitates a stegosaurus. Fortunately, the stegosaurus only takes two swipes at her, both of which miss, and then decides that the problem has been solved. Malcolm is confronting Sarah about coming to the island at 28 minutes, 30 seconds. Sarah says, I've worked around predators since I was 20 years old. And that's exactly why she should have known better. That argument does not hold any water. She's either lying to him or she's an idiot. For her to say, yeah, I knew it would be dangerous, but come on, they're dinosaurs. I'm not going to pass up this chance. That I would buy. But the argument that she's worked around predators, therefore she's safe here. These particular predators are completely unknown, and you can't be prepared for the unknown. That's why they call it unknown. So this argument doesn't hold water, and therefore it's a nit. 29 minutes, 40 seconds. Oh, this one almost won the Will Award. It really did, but the subject of this one is the subject of the Will Award. Surprise, surprise, Malcolm's daughter Kelly stowed away somehow in the equipment and is now on the island. They somehow found a way to ramp up the tension and danger by putting a kid in this situation. Barring the implausibility that she could hide so well nobody knew she was there for 2 or 3 days it took to get here, she's really pretty hardy. Two days without food or water, and she looks like, hey, guess what, I'm a stowaway. How bad a father is Malcolm? He hasn't checked on his daughter once in several days to be aware that she's missing. I'm a father now, and I want him to be a better one. So in addition to our band of merry adventurers, there are some InGen evil type folks out here. 35 minutes, 15 seconds, we are introduced to the InGen weenies when a motorcycle and a Humvee come flying over the ridge into the air. Drivers having such a fun time. Well, this does establish that the InGen team is evil and care nothing for the environment, probably out to abuse the dinosaurs, but this equipment had to be flown in. Guys, you might want to be a little more careful. Because if it breaks, you're screwed. 35 minutes, 23 seconds, the bad guys are chasing dinosaurs. Now, in the middle of a pack, the shot cuts here back to Roland, and there are no dinosaurs to be seen on either side or behind him that were in the wide shot a frame earlier. It also seems very wrong that Roland, the experienced hunter-tracker, does not bother to know the name of the animal he's trying to bring down. Yes, it's a funny moment when he's like, Elvis! But, come on. This guy, you would know the names. There's respect involved in hunting, is my understanding. Maybe that's part of why he's so evil. 41 minutes, 23 seconds. Ah, Roland has discovered the T-Rex nest. That's his MacGuffin for the movie, to bring down a T-Rex and be the first person in history to do that. And he's found the nest. He's watching little baby Rexy have something to eat. There's a bright light shining through the trees behind them. What is this? Somebody turned their headlights on the nest? I know what it is. It's the shuttle from Armageddon. Because in the shuttle, they had a bright light all the time. Anyway, previous podcast. 41 minutes, 50 seconds. Roland, the big, incredibly experienced hunter, says that Rexy's parents won't leave him alone for long. But they do leave him alone They leave him alone long enough for Roland and his friends to tranquilize the baby, tie up the baby, and drag his fat baby Dinobot off to another location. Is Mama off eating a Starbucks or something? 41 minutes, 56 seconds. When Roland and his friend found this nest, where the baby will not be left alone for long, it was mid-afternoon. It's now full-on night. The baby is in the clearing, crying for Mom. There's still no parents in sight. Mama should have been here a long time ago. 44 minutes, 9 seconds. So Nick and Sarah, Nick's the photographer, Sarah's the girlfriend that Dr. Malcolm came to rescue, they have snuck into the InGen camp to cause some havoc and set free a Stegosaurus. It's an Earth-first environmentalist kind of situation. So in order to set free a Stegosaurus, they lift the bar and open the cage. Ta-da, he's free. No one has studied these dinosaurs enough to know whether or not a Stegosaurus can open a cage by himself. And before you think, well, they're just dumb animals, check into what a moose can do with just his nose to open bars of a cage. There are animals that are pretty darn good at getting out of things. This is an extremely rare and expensive animal. I mean, it's about as rare and expensive as it gets. There's no locks on the cage? Seriously? Or a guard, maybe? Anyway, 45 minutes, 35 seconds, Nick and Sarah also let a Triceratops loose, and the InGen meeting right here is broken up by him. He comes into the tent with absolutely no warning, which is a really good trick for a 13-ton dinosaur. I just have this vision of a dinosaur tiptoeing over to the tent, and then with the roaring. 45 minutes, 57 seconds. As the camp goes crazy, one of the vehicle's gas tank explodes for some reason, sending the thing flying into the air. And at about a half mile away, the vehicle lands right on the tree Roland and his friend are hiding in. What are the odds of that? 47 minutes, 49 seconds. So Eddie wants to... I think he's in the high hide at this point. I should have watched this movie before I did this. I didn't. You'll just have to forgive me. But I do know that he's trying to raise the high hide, and then he stops the winch and hits another button to lower the high hide. That's the last time he hits a switch. So the thing hits the ground, and yet the winch does not continue unspooling cable. I could be wrong. Is that a thing? Is it possible that the system is sophisticated enough it can say, oh, I hit the ground, and stop unspooling? Or is it just a mistake? 49 minutes, 43 seconds. World first, an X-ray of a T-Rex, which I think should be called a T-Rex-ray. It seems to go really well. They're X-raying the baby T-Rex to see if its leg is broken. Monitor showing the X-ray has a perfectly good picture, even though the T-Rex is thrashing his whole leg around. It's also lucky for baby T-Rex that no velociraptors stopped in during the hours that he was trussed up like a Thanksgiving turkey and telling the whole island about it. 54 minutes, 35 seconds. So the good guys trying to save the baby T-Rex are now facing down the mama and daddy. And I don't do continuity errors a lot, but for once, I get to do a continuity error with a dinosaur. The T-Rex, 54-35, roars straight on. The shot changes, and a frame later, he's roaring to one side in line with the window, so Sarah's face is framed between his jaw. A frame after the shot changes again, he's roaring straight on. I'm just saying it's a continuity error. There's a long sequence as this double trailer is being pushed off the edge of the cliff by the dinosaurs, by the T-Rexes, and at 58:08, since one half is already over the edge, and it's very well done, it's very gripping, edge of your seat, you know, sweaty palms kind of stuff. But Sarah's on this glass that's slowly starting to crack again. Very well done. It's nice of the T-Rexes to let Sarah get off the glass before they continue pushing the thing off the edge of the cliff. An hour, 1 minute, 10 seconds. Eddie clambers into the trailer, asks our heroes if they're okay. They say they are. Somebody makes a joke about getting some cheeseburgers. Might be nice if one of them says, oh, by the way, Eddie, there's a couple Tyrannosaurus Rexes out here somewhere, and they're really pissed off. 1 hour, 4 minutes, 16 seconds. So Eddie, trying to get the trailer back onto level ground, has been pulling it with the winched Jeep for about 30 seconds. And much like it always amuses me when somebody halfway through a chase scene puts their seatbelt on after several turns and jumps and so forth, after 30 seconds of trying to get the trailers up on the cliff, only now he puts the Jeep into four-wheel drive. 1 hour, 4 minutes, 38 seconds. I definitely would not make a very good action hero. Sarah starts sliding down the rope for no reason that I ever understood. She hits Malcolm and Nick on the way down. All of them are sliding down the rope. Nobody lets go and nobody falls off, despite the fact that this is a rope and none of them have gloves on. I can feel the rope burn they must be experiencing as I'm sitting here, and they are serious adventurers. I will say, though, that this whole entire sequence feels like maybe they padded it to make the movie longer. 1 hour, 4 minutes, 53 seconds. Aha! The Tyrannosaurus Rexes are back. I don't know what they've been doing since they're trying to rescue the baby that I think they still haven't rescued yet, but it was nice of them not to be around when Eddie was out in the open hauling cables around. 1 hour, 5 minutes, 33 seconds. T-Rex pulls the driver's seat out of the Jeep by the roots, and the airbag deploys. Is that right? Would an airbag deploy just because the seat was yanked out? I'm not a car designer, but it seemed weird. That will move on. There are other things in the sequence, but I don't want to pad this podcast the way they pad in the movie, so we'll move on. 1 hour, 8 minutes, 58 seconds. Finally, the Velociraptors come into the movie, like we knew they would eventually. And the guy from InGen says the Velociraptors have binocular vision. How does he know this? He doesn't seem to say, we think, or it doesn't seem, he doesn't at all say, we think, we assume, we theorize. No, he just says, no, they have a lot of binocular vision. How have they discovered this based on fossils alone? And do they have a little wheel between their eyes to set the focus? What? 1 hour, 11 minutes, 53 seconds. So the remaining humans have decided to troop through the island to try to find a way to get off the island. And Roland, the big game hunter, is in the middle of the pack. I find it very surprising that the biggest alpha male on the island is not leading the pack. Then again, maybe he's thinking that if he's not leading the pack, he has less of a chance of being eaten by dinosaurs. 1 hour, 12 minutes, 2 seconds. For all that Sarah is supposed to be this amazing animal person, she doesn't seem to know much about animals. She's wearing a jacket covered in T-Rex blood, and she doesn't realize that's a danger. It's not like it's even dried. It smears all over one of the leaves she brushes past. Can she not smell this stuff? I mean, I'm pretty sure I can, and I'm just sitting in a room watching, recording a podcast thinking about the movie. And I can pretty much still smell that blood. Oh, this also almost won the Will Award. It's about Roland's gun. Roland the big game hunter. Roland for whom his rifle, his weapon, is his right arm. I have heard that there are branches of the military where, like in boot camp, in training camp, where if you allow your rifle to touch the ground, you have to spend the next week carrying it with you everywhere you go. You're not allowed to put it down, like, at all. Much like football players fumble a ball, they have to spend a day or two of the next week carrying a ball at all times. So this rifle is extremely important. It's his newborn baby, if you will. And yet he puts it down and walks into the bushes to check on something or go to the bathroom or whatever. He walks away from this gun, 1 hour, 12 minutes, 38 seconds. I don't believe that at all. Never going to happen. 1 hour, 13 minutes, 23 seconds. The Russian Yuri, who none of us are very fond of, heads off to answer nature's call. A guy named Yuri, he's about to go... Well, if you didn't finish the joke, then never mind. But despite the recent T-Rex attack, he doesn't walk like 2 feet into the forest or just do it right there on the edge of the trail. No, he has to walk like 300 yards into the forest. This is not a good time to be all shy if you're going to go urinate. Anyway, you see, I made the joke after all. It happened. 1 hour, 21 minutes, 16 seconds. Some of the people have survived till nighttime. We're in our tents. Sarah hears the T-Rex stomping around. She slowly raises her head, and there's a light on her face. She's sleeping in a tent with a light on in the midst of dinosaur country, and just for fun, she points it at her face. Again, on the theme of how bad Sarah is when she's supposed to be a really good animal person,
We see her at 1 hour, 21 minutes, 42 seconds, frantically shoving candy bar wrappers into a Ziploc bag. These animals are like 100 times worse than bears. Wouldn't it be prudent to take at least bear-like precautions, like not leaving food out or traveling for miles with a blood-soaked jacket? And then she shoves the Ziploc bag under the edge of her sleeping bag, because that will keep the T-Rex from smelling anything. 1 hour, 23 minutes, 41 seconds. You know how I said it was amazing that Roland would leave his gun behind? Well, he had to, so that Nick could mess with it, so that right now it would fail to fire. I'm just saying it was nice that Roland read the script and was like, oh, well, I have to leave my gun behind for someone to mess with. Oh, dear. And when I come back from whatever I went out in the woods to do, I must make sure not to check the weapon and see if it's working properly. It's ridiculously unlikely. 1 hour, 23 minutes, 59 seconds. The people are fleeing. The T-Rex is chasing them. The T-Rex that can run three times as fast as a human, supposedly, the one that was catching up to the Jeep in the last film, he's just sort of trudging now, roaring at them. He's not trotting on anyone or picking up any bite-sized human McNuggets. 1 hour, 24 minutes, 57 seconds. Roland, the big game hunter, firing tranquilizers at a gigantic dinosaur, can't be bothered to take any cover while he's doing so. Just stands out in the open and fires. How weird that Rexy suddenly takes an interest in him. 1 hour, 25 minutes, 15 seconds. Every movie waterfall has a cave behind it. Every one. I'm still looking for one in real life, is all I'm saying. So they escape the Tyrannosaurus Rex, including the very long, nasty tongue, and now they're trying to catch up with the people that recently went into the tall field and were eaten by the Velociraptors. They've gotten to the tall field. Malcolm has figured out that there's Velociraptors. He's like, go, as fast as you can. Frankly, I'd be off running my little cute butt off. I wouldn't wait around for Malcolm to dramatically respond, go! Which everybody else does. 1 hour, 28 minutes, 18 seconds. Why don't our heroes get attacked by the V-Raps? That's my new slang for Velociraptor, because it's a hard word to say. They get to the other side of the long grass. Everybody's unscathed. Did the V-Raps get all full with the previous people? It's nice to have some nice to have some Star Trek red shirt guys around, isn't it? He said. Moving on. 1 hour, 32 minutes, 41 seconds. Bad enough that we have regular V-Raps. Now we have Ninja V-Raps. And yes, that would be an excellent name for a band. 1:32:41, a Velociraptor from nowhere jumps on the Jeep that Sarah just walked past. It's not like he dove out of cover either. He just appears out of nowhere. Considering that he's computer-generated, I guess he really did appear out of nowhere. 1 hour, 32 minutes, 45 seconds. Sure is lucky for Sarah, the animal attacks her pack. And not her. And too bad everybody else that we didn't know by name, therefore care about, did not have the same luck with the Velociraptors. 1 hour, 33 minutes, 47 seconds. This might not be a nit. Maybe the Velociraptor chasing Malcolm is just a little loopy. But I think the effects guys just wanted to break some extra glass. The animal breaks through into the room, and Malcolm gets out of the room, and so the Velociraptor then breaks out through the next available pane of glass instead of just coming out through the hole he just made. This is an animal. It's going to do things as easily and simply as possible. It's not going to break extra glass just for the fun of breaking extra glass. This is a V-Rap we're talking about. Another continuity error, and I'm bringing this one up because it's the second movie in a row, podcast-wise, that had a glass error, 1:33:54, between looking at the V-Rap from the inside of the truck to the POV shot from the outside. The hole in the glass goes from pin-sized to rock-sized. 1 hour, 36 minutes, 3 seconds. The Will Award. And if you know this movie well, you know what I'm about to say. How incredibly amazing that the support beams or bars or whatever's going on in this shack are exactly the right height and spacing and elasticity, because they bend a little bit for Kelly to perform her gymnastics parallel bars routine and freak out the Velociraptors. It's not at all cheesy or ridiculous or implausible. I'm being sarcastic. Although, I will admit, I love Malcolm's line after she's done. They cut you from the team? 1 hour, 40 minutes, 35 seconds. They've finally gotten into a helicopter. The last chopper out of Dinosaur Saigon. They just want to get away from this island. Sarah sees that InGen has trapped a T-Rex. Not content with just looking through a perfectly good window, she has to open the chopper door to get a really good look, and nobody says anything? These people are really shell-shocked. Now, InGen has decided to bring a T-Rex to San Diego. This is where the movie really gets fun. And at 1 hour 43 minutes, we see a radar screen showing the ship heading for the San Diego dock and not slowing down. At the rate it's moving on the screen, it should hit the dock in about 30 seconds, but it actually takes more than twice that to do so. I will admit the shot of the container ship coming out of the fog and not slowing down is really, really fantastic. I don't know if they did it in miniatures or if they really built a dock and really beat the crap out of it, but it's a great shot. 1 hour, 44 minutes, 22 seconds. I called this a nit, but I think I was wrong. The ship went out of control because there's nobody on the bridge to slow it down. So the big old T-Rex somehow squeezed onto the bridge and ate everybody? Probably not, but you've got a T-Rex on the loose. Even the person who's responsible for slowing the ship down could be unconscious or in shock or something. So I think I was wrong on that one. However, 1 hour, 47 minutes, 15 seconds, when Rexy stomps past the no fruits, vegetables, or animals beyond this point sign, which is a great movie moment, we see an office full of frantic people. Not one of them is looking out the windows at the Tyrannosaurus. Yeah, the whole, I guess I've already said this, the premise of a T-Rex loose in San Diego is, well, you know what? I'm going to nitpick myself. I called it in the book ridiculously implausible, but if you've bought that they've cloned dinosaurs, the dinosaur amber, the fly-in amber dinosaur DNA, let's clone them thing, that's the ridiculously implausible part. If you buy that, and I do, I love Jurassic Park, then why wouldn't they bring a dinosaur to, you know, a T-Rex to San Diego? And if it broke free, it would stomp around in San Diego. It's not ridiculously implausible. However, what is the fact, 149.06, that as Rex stomps around this upscale California neighborhood, his stomping isn't setting off car alarms, it's not getting people out of bed, nobody has notified the police this thing is out here. I mean, it's not like New York, where apparently, I've never been, you can do anything and nobody notices because they're so blasé. This is California. I'd like to think Californians would notice a dinosaur. Back me up, California. 1 hour, 51 minutes, 17 seconds. So Malcolm and Sarah have found the baby T-Rex, and they're like, aha, we can use the baby T-Rex to lure Mama and Daddy, or whoever, yeah, we'll say Mom and Daddy, back onto the ship, and then trap them for the authorities to deal with, rather than just taking the car and driving away from where the T-Rex is, because they know so much more about dinosaurs, and they can handle it. It's funny to me, again, 1 hour, 51 minutes, 17 seconds, that as she's bending over the baby T-Rex, Sarah hasn't bothered to tie her hair back. I will tell it to you straight. If I'm ever dealing with a Tyrannosaurus Rex within 10 miles of me, I will want all the peripheral vision I can find. 1 hour, 52 minutes, 43 seconds. Even the buses in Hollywood are set up for special effects. The T-Rex clocks the bus a good one on its side, rocking it up on its wheels a little, and several people are thrown out of the windows. I mean, come on. I saw the movie Speed. Nothing like that happened with all that bus went through. It's just a little ridiculous. Oh, the bus has shifted slightly. Three people are out the windows. 1 hour, 52 minutes, 50 seconds. As the bus crashes into the video store, look for a big poster of Arnold Schwarzenegger in King Lear, which must have happened in the Jurassic Park world, because I don't think it's happened in this one. How sharper than a serpent's tooth it is to have a thankless child. Blow, winds, and crack your cheeks. Rage, blow. You cataracts and hurricanoes spout till you have drenched your teeples, drowned the cocks. You sulfur roarer and thought-executing fires. Vaunt couriers to oak-cleaving thunderbolts. Singe my white head. And thou, all shaking thunder, strike flat the thick rotundity of the world. Crack nature's molds. All germs spill at once that make ingrateful man. While you're at it, get to the chopper. I know, it's self-indulgent, but come on, how often do you get to hear Arnold Schwarzenegger as King Lear? 1 hour, 53 minutes, 48 seconds. So Malcolm and Sarah have got the baby T-Rex. They've got him back in the cargo hold. They need to lure Daddy into the cargo hold. They'll never know we have it if this thing won't make some kind of sound. This is the Tyrannosaurus Rex they're talking about. It won't be aware of his kidnapped child unless the child cries out. Isn't this the same T-Rex that could track the child by scent for up to 10 miles? He's 100 feet away. Where are those vaunted scent glands? He got a cold on the way over? 1 hour, 55 minutes, 15 seconds. So they've put the T-Rex down. Nope, they haven't. Sorry. I'm reading my writing. I got a little ahead of myself. Malcolm and Sarah are on foot. They're running from the T-Rex. They've got the kid in their arms. Chase us, so we can trap you. Two steps, he can catch them. Somehow the Rex doesn't squash or chomp either of them. Yes, he needs to be careful around his baby, but still, come on. 1 hour, 55 minutes, 33 seconds. Malcolm and Sarah run past the InGen weenie, baby in their arms, and the Rex has disappeared. 1 hour, 59 minutes. The T-Rex is shot with a trank dart for the second time. Having a rough day. This time seems to feel the effects immediately. Although the first time, he turned around and looked at Roland the Hunter like nothing had happened. Maybe Nick took all the tranquilizer out of the tranquilizer darts. But they finally trap Rexy, and they take him back where he came from, and deposit him on the Costa Rican island, and now no one will ever be here, and they'll never make a third or fourth movie. 2 hours, 1 minute, 26 seconds. You know, I think it's humans that are the problem. Obviously, based on this scene, the T-Rexes aren't that bad. The whole family's on the island. They're within spitting distance of a herd of stegosauri. Nobody's bothering anybody. A pterodactyl comes in to land. Pterodactyl, sorry, the P is silent. You know, they're all just playing nice. It's the humans, really, that are the problem. And that's some of my thoughts about The Lost World Jurassic Park, and that is pretty much all of the podcast for this fortnight. Now, next time around, in 2 weeks, we're going to do something different. I don't think I'm done with nitpicking forever, but we've done 10 movies, and it's time to switch tracks and do something else. It's going to be new and exciting, and I hope you'll come back and see what it is. But in the meantime, hey, own your stage, even if that stage has a Velociraptor on it, all right? And we'll see you back here soon.